Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Senator Gary Hart is with us this hour. He has a new book in which he says a lot. He's a deep thinker. But he talks about America's founders who created, he writes, a republic, knowing that it, like all republics from ancient Athens and Rome onward, would be vulnerable to corruption. From 400 BC onward, corruption of the Republican ideal took the form of narrow individual and special interests taking precedence over the common good and the commonwealth. By these classic standards, he writes, the American Republic in the 21st century is massively corrupt, a vast and cancerous network of lobbying, campaign fundraising, and access to policymakers and administrations and lawmakers in Congress, and it is based purely and simply on special and narrow interests. Can that long survive is one of the questions we'll ask this hour. Senator Gary Hart represented Colorado in the U.S. Senate from 1975 to 1987. He sought the Democratic nomination for president in 84 and 88. He was appointed to be the U.S. Special Envoy for Northern Ireland in October of 2014. And he has written a number of books. He received a doctorate in philosophy from Oxford. He has taught at prestigious places all over the country. He's a professor at the University of Colorado, distinguished fellow at the America Foundation, New America, and chair of the American Security Project. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Senator Gary Hart. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Senator Gary Hart, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. And thank you for thinking so deeply about things that we should all be thinking about. I mean, isn't it time to think about the common good, the public good? I would say that it probably is. Let's talk about, there's much to talk about. Somebody gave me a statistic, a member of Congress or former member of Congress, Senator Hart, some years ago about how the increasing number of days that senators and people in Congress have to spend on the phone asking for money so they can be reelected, and it almost becomes your primary job. It's a large amount of a week now, isn't it?
Well, I haven't added it up, and I haven't seen those numbers. I do know more than one senator has said to me that it is routine for members of the Senate to leave their offices for 2 hours a day to go to their respective party headquarters, Democratic or Republican, and do nothing for those 2 hours but make phone calls asking for contributions. And that's not the fifth year in office looking towards reelection. That's the first year throughout the 6 years. So when you're making phone calls for money, you're not doing your job.
Mm-hmm. When you think about, and you've thought long and hard about the republic our founders created and hoped would be perpetuated, what did they hope would be created?
Well, the ancient republic, amazing number of those extraordinary people, men almost exclusively, read in classical Greek and Latin, and they read the classical writers about politics, Plato, Aristotle, and the others, Cato and many others, in the original language. And they were immensely attracted to the concept of the Republic as a model for America. And what they faced, frankly, was a challenge of scope and scale, because republics in the past have all been small. They required citizen participation, and no one up until the time of the founding of this country had figured out a formula whereby you could have a large-scale republic, and they did it through a theory of federation. Leaving that aside, what they knew, as your introduction said, was that republics in the past had always succumbed to corruption, and they did not define corruption as we do today, being bribery or money under the table or quid pro quo favors. They said, as you indicated, that corruption was placing special interest ahead of what today we would call the national interest. And if you apply that formula or that definition to 21st century American government, then we are massively corrupt, because there are now more than $4 billion a year spent on lobbying for special interests. Now we have over 400 former members of Congress who are themselves lobbyists. And so an intricate network of power and privilege has been formed in Washington, I think, primarily in the last 25 or 30 years, and it is corrupting our nation.
Mm-hmm. You write in the book that when you were in the U.S. Senate, we just didn't have those kinds of lobbyists. People weren't going from Congress to become lobbyists. Why did it begin after you left? What happened?
Well, that's a very good question, and I don't have the answer for it. A whole combination of things, I'm sure. But once the dam broke and members of Congress realized how much money they could make by leaving one house or the other and joining either a blatant lobbying firm or a law firm which specialized in lobbying, they understood they could make hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of dollars. And that's when the change began. And it also reflected, I think, a change of values as well. The great senators I served with in the 70s and beyond of both parties would not have, I wouldn't say demeaned themselves, they simply would not have traded the title given them by their constituents for money to put in their pocket. They simply wouldn't do it. And I could name names, and not one of them ever thought about becoming a lobbyist. Now it's becoming routine.
Mm-hmm. You remind us of Eric Cantor, who lost an election and went to work for Wall Street. Now he's a millionaire now, right?
Apparently so, and that's a quote from a column in the New York Times about the very phenomenon we're talking about, how much money needs to be raised for election and re-election, and then once you're not elected anymore, you continue to raise money, only this time it's for yourself.
We're looking at what, perhaps over $2 billion presidential race?
Well, excuse me, according to at least one of the announced candidates, she intends to spend at one point $1 billion, and then later that was changed to $2.5 billion.
Goodness.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah. Where does all that money go? I don't have a satisfactory answer to that yet. Does it go to TV stations?
Yes.
It does.
80 to 90 cents on the campaign dollar goes for paid media. And many of the TV stations and networks routinely decry the cost of campaigns,
mm-hmm.
even though they're benefiting from it hugely.
And you talk about how much money it costs to run for Congress. It's millions and millions of dollars. Obviously, you're eliminating a huge number of people who might be very, very excellent public servants simply because of the money. They can't afford it.
Well, they personally can't afford it, and they will not make the bargains with contributors that too many candidates now have to make. Take, for example, people say, well, look, there are 12 or 15 people on the Republican side, so it must be open for everyone. But there has been what political analysts have called individual billionaire primaries, casino magnates, car dealers,
yes.
who've made fortunes, and the Koch brothers and others who hold their own primary. And they invite candidates to come appear before them. And if
yes.
the one that sides with their interests and concerns the most gets their support.
When you said that, obviously we know what's going on, but just when you said that, if you pause for a moment and ponder that, people would think, well, we don't want that. That's absurd that they should be making the decisions for us.
Well, it's the ultimate in corruption, I think. When a person can make that much money, which is fine if it's done legally, but then to turn that to the political process and as an individual begin to dominate
mm-hmm.
and seek to dominate both the nomination of those who can run for for the presidency or for the nomination of a party, and then the presidency itself. So it's from the standpoint of someone who's been at this for 40 or more years, it's out of control.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to go through anything like that when you ran for office, Senator Hart?
No, my first, well, I'll qualify that later, but my first campaign as a 36-year-old, never having run for office before, for the Senate, in 1974, in a contested primary against a two-term incumbent, the whole thing cost $375,000, and the average contribution was $17. So that's this just in my active lifetime. That's how much things have changed. And, of course, there's the famous situation from your state of William Proxmire, who used to run for re-election spending $152.
Right. I love this story. I knew him because I've been in the business a long time. But I love the story about William Proxmire getting the overnight slot, buying the overnight time slot in a radio station in northern Wisconsin, and he would just put himself on the air all night long, interviewing himself. That's can you imagine doing that now?
he was legendary. Served with him.
Yeah, he sure was legendary. And then let's move to this whole area of, and I want you to talk about this at some length, the disappearance of a sense of the national interest. So people are kind of mad that we have all these pressing issues with us right now. We have terrorist groups, we have climate change that could just ruin our planet, and yet we don't seem to be realizing that these are areas that we need very, very deliberate conversations. Congress needs to be doing this. We all need to be doing this. There is a sense of the national interest, but nobody's addressing it. How do we lose the national interest?
Well, I think there are those, and of course, climate change, those who advocate against fossil fuels and so forth, believe very strongly that they themselves are promoting and protecting the national interest, and to a large degree they are, because they are not doing so for their own personal aggrandizement, but they are up against a tide of corporate spending, now legitimized by the highest court in this country, in Citizens United, which made the preposterous conclusion that the Constitution intended for a legal fiction called a corporation to have the same rights of free speech and spending money as an individual American. I don't know any C student in any law school in the country that believes that.
What needs to happen for people who believe, as you do, that that needs to be overturned? Are you an advocate for a constitutional amendment?
Well, you can advocate for it, but it's not going to happen. What needs to change is the court, and that's one of the slowest processes and that we know, because often justices stay there for 30, 40 or more years, and no one there right now seems to be in the process of leaving. So the next election will be important, because surely there will be two or three seats to fill, and that's going to be a key issue for future court, for a future court. And it's throughout our history, as you know, the court has reversed itself on race, on gender, on all kinds of other things, and it's certainly going to have to reverse itself on this.
Mm. Getting back to money and politics for a moment, you do remind us, and certainly President Obama's campaign reminds us, that there are still successful attempts to do internet donations. Certainly Senator Bernie Sanders has been hauling in, I mean, not huge amounts of money, but a lot of $40 contributions from a number of people. Does that indicate that there is an alternative, that there is hope?
That is the best thing that's happened in recent years in terms of cleaning up the system. And it did begin, I think, with the 08 campaign for then-Senator Obama and the realization that the Internet did permit a candidate to reach out to millions, if not tens of millions, of everyday Americans who would send in $10 or $15 or $25. And that's the healthiest kind of money in politics. So one hopes that that potential will be tapped and rise above the special interest money. But it's been documented over and over again. The amount of money corporate America puts into politics is in the billions of dollars, and it gets what it pays for, by and large. And that's what we have to change.
Senator Gary Hart is our guest this hour. His latest book is The Republic of Conscience. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We welcome your participation in this show, and I'm sure that many of you have a lot to respond to and thoughts of your own. He calls this a book, One Citizen's Testament. He says, a testament to the political faith of our founders, an imperfect attempt to shine a light on a perfectly clear record made over a few months in late 18th century America, and to contrast that clear record with early 21st century America. We have some issues that we need to pay attention to. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Senator Gary Hart is with us now, represented Colorado in the U.S. Senate from 1975 to 1987. He is the author of many books, including the one we're talking about this hour, The Republic of Conscience, other books, Restoration of the Republic, The Jeffersonian Ideal, and The Courage of Our Convictions, A Manifesto for Democrats. He has lectured all over the country, and he is a professor at the University of Colorado now, distinguished fellow at the New America Foundation, and chair of the American Security Project. Let's go to phone calls, and we'll start with Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good afternoon, Kathy. Good afternoon, Senator. I had one question in terms of your issue of the Republic. Do you think we should abolish, in the interest of one man, one voter, one person, one vote, should we abolish the Electoral College and have a popularly elected executive? For in the year 2000, that would have not have resulted in the election of George Bush, and we probably would have avoided the Iraq War. My other question is your comments on the continuing decline of corporations, taxation and their contribution to our budget versus the continued rise of taxation upon the individual. Thank you.
Well, I'll have to have you repeat the second
your comment.
Somebody was trying to reach, call in on this line, and it interrupted the question, but the response to the first question is, I'm ambivalent on that. I don't like changing the Constitution. But the reason for the Electoral College, as we know, in the late 18th century was because of the time it took to communicate the results of votes and the results of those votes being presented in person by electors in Washington to cast the votes of the respective states. That day is well over, so I think we could get rid of the Electoral College. I don't think it adds anything particular to our constitutional form of government. The question on taxation, please repeat it if you can.
Yeah, it was, he's not with us anymore, but it was about the declining rate of corporate income taxes.
Well, this is, we have one of the highest rates, the facts are important, we have one of the highest corporate tax rates in the industrialized world, and corporate America never ceases to remind legislators and the public that they, in theory at least, pay higher taxes than their competitors in Europe or elsewhere, mostly in Europe. But on the other hand, the tax laws are replete with loopholes of where corporations can set up offshore accounts, set up offshore subsidiaries, avoid paying taxes for quite a long period of time. So the legal tax rate, that is to say what the law requires, and the effective tax rate, there is a great deal of difference. And when you apply the effective corporate tax rate in America to the international standard, well, we're pretty much where everybody else is.
Let's go to Dick in Appleton. Hi, Dick.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Why don't we just admit that we have four branches of government, and the fourth one is the lobbyist, and that's supported by the corporations and the 1%, and for the most part, they're running the laws of the country, and it's their agenda that's working.
Well, this is, first of all, I think it's important to make two points. Lobbying itself is not illegal, and the corruption we're talking about here is all of which is virtually all of which is legal. When I was in Congress, and I pointed out that virtually no one that served in the Senate of that time walked out the door to make money lobbying, Coloradans would visit, interest groups would visit. There was, in fact, there is off the floor of both houses, a large ornate room called the lobby. And it's been there virtually from the beginning. So there's nothing wrong with that. It's when it overwhelms it through the demand for special interest consideration tied to campaign contributions, when it overwhelms the entire political system, and that has been in the last 25 to 30 years, that it becomes dangerous to the future of this republic. But that's point number one. The history of this country, there have been political scandals before. Teapot Dome comes to mind. These were, by and large, classic corruption. That is to say, not a classic corruption, but menial corruption of the bribery sort. And people have gone to jail, been prosecuted, and so on. But there was also a time when the financial oligarchy, late 19th, early 20th century, the robber barons, had about as much impact on legislation and on the government in Washington as the corporations do now. But what we're waking up to the fact is, as I try to point out in the book, it changes the nature of our government if it persists, and it seems as if it will persist till we get control of campaign finance costs. Then you don't have a republic. You have some different form of government, and to prevent that, the American people have to do what they've done in the past, and that is rise up and demand reform.
Talk about the narrowing of choices for candidates for office, and I know that your book addresses this. You say at one point, if the national presidency were to pass back and forth between two or three families in any Latin American nation, we would call it an oligarchy. But if those families can use carefully built political networks to raise a billion or perhaps now multiple billions to seek the presidency, what hope is there for the new voice? I've said this before in the air, but I keep thinking, and with all due respect to both the Bush family and the Clinton family, it is kind of amazing, isn't it, Senator Hart, that those two people, Hillary and Jeb, could very well be the nominees for the next presidential contest, and the families have been around for such a long period of time. It's just striking to me.
Well, it is indeed. I personally have known President Clinton and Mrs. Clinton for 40 years. I admire and respect them. But we're now facing the fourth Clinton presidential campaign. And on the other side, I think this is now the sixth or seventh national campaign in which a member of the Bush family has been on the ticket or seeking to be on the ticket. And there is something confining about that in terms of the chance for new ideas, new thoughts, new people to come into government at a time when the realities are changing.
Mm-hmm.
The America in 2015 and 16 is a much different country and in a much different world even than during the Clinton presidency of the 1990s. So to have another Clinton term or two with virtually the same people in office, recycling, the same Rolodexes, and many of the same policies, is not going to address this country's problems. And in terms of Governor Bush, he is priding himself on the fact that a lot of policy advisors of his brother and his father are now supporting him. Same problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same problem on television, too, particularly with cable TV when you watch those shows. And I do confess I watch some of them because I like politics. But it's the same people talking all the time. You think of all the great minds in the country, and they never get to the airwaves.
Well, I wouldn't say never, but, you know, if the O'Reillys of the world and people like that hang on for 20 or 30 years saying the same thing that their audience wants them to
right.
say, that's not educating the American people.
Yeah.
Let me make another point.
Okay.
We haven't defined the Commonwealth. One of the things that belongs to all of us, the Commonwealth and the common good, is all the things we own together. The national parks and recreation areas and natural resources, the air and the water, transportation systems, the list goes on. One of those things that we've almost all never remember is that we own the airwaves. Fox News, right. NBC, mm-hmm. and CBS do not own the airwaves. They license them from us. The American people can demand that those networks make time available to candidates to make their case at no cost.
And you would hope that most people in broadcasting would think every day about serving the public interest.
Well, they used to. We used to, as you recall, used to have something called the Fairness Doctrine mm-hmm. back in the old days, before partisan media and talk radio came along. And that doctrine, it wasn't a law, it was a regulation of the Federal Communications Commission. By virtue of having a license to the airwaves, if somebody on your network made an argument on a key issue, you had to give equal time or relatively equal time to the other side of that case. Guess what? Mr. Murdoch came to town in the mid-1980s. President Ronald Reagan abolished the Fairness Doctrine, and that's when we began to get so-called fair and balanced partisan media.
Right. Thanks, Dick, very much for your call. Our number lines are open for you now if you've been trying to get through. 800-486-8655. Senator Gary Hart is our guest, and we're talking about his new book, The Republic of Conscience. Sarah in Winona, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thanks, Senator. I was wondering, speaking on politics, Bernie Sanders was just in Rochester, Minnesota, and he gave an awesome speech. He doesn't want to take money from the billionaires. He wants to push forward and start that revolution with all of us. Then on Sunday morning, you see NBC, four people talking on the television in the morning, and they say Bernie Sanders doesn't have a chance. And if he does have a chance, the Republicans want him on the ballot because of all the people that are Republican, they think that his socialist ideas are going to blow him out of the water because of all the Republicans. So it's like, how does Bernie have a chance? How can we keep fighting for a guy like this? How do we get him on the airwaves? You know, I mean, I'm here standing here saying his name now, but we want to keep pushing forward. And like you said, we control the airwaves. So how can we keep pushing forward with trying to do what you're saying, getting money out of politics? And Bernie Sanders is a great candidate for that, but also fighting the Republicans.
Well, I think the best thing all of us could do, and I include myself, is not pay one bit of attention to the political pundits for the next 8 months, because until the voters, the caucus attendees in Iowa, and the voters, primary voters in New Hampshire are heard from, we're not going to know who the serious candidates are. And all of this hot air that's going on now, who's up, who's down, the polls, and all of that nonsense, will just be gone the day after the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary. My experience in 1984 was, in running against the prohibitive frontrunner, who ended up getting the nomination by virtue of the new superdelegates, I ran second in Iowa. I started out at 2% in the polls and then won the New Hampshire primary, and the whole race changed. So don't rule that out, and take everything you hear between now and then with a pound of salt.
Thank you, Sarah, very much.
It's not just Bernie Sanders, by the way. I think Governor Martin O'Malley deserves to be heard. He's a new voice, new generation. Jim Webb, senator from Virginia, is entering the race. Let's wait and let everybody be heard from, and the pundits just forget about the polls for the time being.
What will we do with our talk shows, Senator Hart?
That's their problem. Maybe have enlightened discourse.
Okay. We'll do that, we promise. I've been meaning to ask you, it's funny how names come up and here you are having written a book, but we spent a lot of time talking about you with James Fallows, who's our guest on this show somewhat often, and I really appreciate what he has to say. He wrote a piece in The Atlantic, how Gary Hart tried to change military history, and spoke at some length about the committee that you headed looking at, and he called you the Democratic Party's most most experienced and best connected figure on defense reform to form this task force to draft recommendations on how President Obama might try to recast the Pentagon if he won a second term. And you did this full report, and James said that you never heard back. Is that true? Have you ever heard back?
No.
No.
Well, I proposed the idea to President Obama. He didn't call me up. I got his David Axelrod, his former chief of staff, set up an appointment. I proposed to him that he do what Harry Truman did in the 1940s after World War II, and that is pick half a dozen to a dozen very bright people who knew national security and ask them to go away for 6 months and come back with some ideas for reforming the military for the 21st century. And I made the argument to him, and he turned to me and said, I'm not going to do it, but I want you to do it. So I put an ad hoc group of very, very intelligent people together, including Jim Fallows, and 6 to 8 months later, we presented a 2,500-word document with, I think, about 10 or 12 specific recommendations for reform to the president. And from that then on, we weren't looking for thanks or recognition or acknowledgement, but just hope that he would institute some of those changes.
Well, I'm disappointed that you never heard anything, because...
Oh, well, he's busy.
Well, right, but so are all of you and all the other great minds you worked with. But it made me want to ask you what it is we do, what recommendations you made that would be pertinent to the way that we are fighting or our lack of success in fighting some of these groups like ISIS. What are we doing wrong here? What? Because people are worried about it and could go on and on and on, and the killings are awful and it's spreading, and whatever we're doing doesn't seem to be doing much good.
Well, you never know. Everybody who's studied the war against the Islamic State has said it's going to take a long, long time. And when former President Bush got us wholesale into Afghanistan and Iraq, what he did not realize, and very few others did not realize, despite some military warnings, we were going to be there for a while, and those were the two longest wars in American history. And in some ways, in Iraq at least, continue to be so. So the nature of warfare has changed. Our mentality is still World War II with great armies in the field. Our force structures are still big army divisions of 10,000 men and nuclear aircraft carrier task forces for the Navy and long-range bomber wings for the Air Force. And those are not effective in this new kind of indigenous, irregular, urban warfare that we're now facing. The one innovation that many of us called for, some of us called for years ago, was special forces, specially trained for this new kind of or old kind of warfare, and we're getting around to that, and they are the frontline troops now.
All right, more phone calls for Senator Gary Hart, Jake in Oshkosh. Hi.
Great show, Kathleen. Great guest. I wanted to ask the guest, is he familiar with Rob Nader's book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance, Dismantle the Corporate State? Are you familiar with that?
I am familiar with it. I can't confess to having read it, though. I know Mr. Nader, but I have not read that book.
In one of his chapters, he talks about 25 proposed redirections and reforms through convergent action between the left and right to dismantle the corporate state, and it's definitely worth a read. So that's what I have to say.
All right.
Well, I appreciate it, and that's another topic we could spend a lot of time on, what's liberal and what's conservative now, because things are pretty muddled, and the old categories aren't taking account of how the world has changed. People are twisted into pretzels on the trade issue and immigration, a whole range of things like that. There's wide disparity. The Republican Party used to be unified. Now there's wide disparity within the Republican Party into factions of libertarians and evangelicals and all kinds of other things. So a part of this is the refusal of politics in America to fit into the two categories the political pundits want to force everyone into.
Thanks, Jake. We go to Richard in Land of Lakes. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you, Richard?
Wonderful. Well, thanks for taking my call. I'm just in awe of this program. As I sit out looking at Lafayette is there in the Great North Woods, listening to such a well-informed guest, Gary Hart, I'm so impressed. It's just wonderful to hear educated conversations about topical subjects and knowing full well that I'm living in a state where the governor himself would be at his wit's end to know that there is this type of conversation going on in the middle of the day in his fair state about these issues that really are weighing us down as a nation, as a people. But I think it all comes back to education. We seem to be moving away from education and going more toward consumption. Anyway, thanks for taking my call. This is just sort of a shout-out to you and your radio station and Senator Gary Hart. Thanks.
Thank you, Richard.
Well, he reflects Thomas Jefferson, who said we would not have a democracy without public education, and he was absolutely right. Part of the theory of the republic is citizen participation, what they used to call civic virtue. But to participate, you have to know what you're talking about, not just talking points from Rush Limbaugh or O'Reilly, but serious, thoughtful consideration of complex issues. And the way you do that is read the newspapers, and there were more newspapers in colonial America than there are today, I think. And everybody read them and talked about them. And enlightened discourse, not slogans and not talking points, but thoughtful deliberations among citizens and their leaders.
Hmm. Let's talk about transparency for a moment. There's been a big hullabaloo in Wisconsin over the past few days. I don't know if you're aware of it. You probably read something about it, but there was an attempt by the Joint Finance Committee to pretty much do away with Wisconsin's open records. It created a big stir among Democrats and among Republicans. The members of the committee had to backtrack here. There's still some talk about identifying who it was who wanted to move Wisconsin to essentially a closed kind of government. I'm interested in your thoughts about transparency because I know, Senator Hart, that you've written about them in your book.
It's absolutely crucial to our form of government, whether you call it a democracy or a republic. The power in a republic belongs to the people. It's called popular sovereignty. It does not belong to elected officials. It does not belong to governors or presidents. It belongs to us, the people of the United States. And we give that power to various officials, but we still retain control of it. So legislators do not have autonomous power that they derive from the ether somewhere or from taking an oath of office. They get it from us. And we have to know what they're doing on our behalf or against our behalf in their duties as legislators, regulators, governors, or whatever. Every time things have been hidden in this country, there is a destruction of democracy, whether it's Watergate or any of this kind of penny-ante stuff that happens at the state or local level. There are some negative trends going on in this country right now. That is to restrict voting, to shut off information to the public, to confine power to a handful of people. And it's the most destructive trend in certainly since Watergate, if not before.
Senator Gary Hart, our guest, his new book is The Republic of Conscience. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. He was a member of the U.S. Senate for a number of years, 75 to 87. He ran for president in 84 and 88. He has written many books. He has been at many universities, and he was in Northern Ireland as well recently. Special envoy, U.S. special envoy for Northern Ireland, just in the past year. Well, we're welcoming phone calls for him, and here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Senator Gary Hart is with us now, and let us go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi.
Kathleen, Senator Hart. Talking about education and through reading magazines and newspapers, which there are very few compared to what they used to be, I would say that I don't know if you, if I didn't hear you, but you didn't mention the computer at YouTube and the internet system.
Yep.
Where you can get infinite knowledge of different things that have happened, that are happening, that without censorship, whereas the media is controlled and censored. And one thing that did impress me when I read it, when I saw, I just happened to run across it, where Senator Tom Daschle, you probably knew him. He was, after 9/11, he was having press conferences, and he was asking that, he was saying that the Senate, the President and the Vice President told him that they did not want a Senate investigation of 9/11, and he couldn't believe it. And
what about information on the internet? Is it a good source? Is it liberating for us, Senator Hart?
Well, he makes a very good point, and one that I should have made. We have more information now than we've ever had in our history, including at the founding era, and it is there for, it's like Mencken said about a free press. There's a free press for everyone who owns one. We have computer information for everybody who owns a computer, and almost all of us do, except for those who are just scraping by. But we do have more information. I think there's less thoughtful, intelligent analysis of it. Not that it needs to be filtered, but I'm old enough to remember Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley,
mm-hmm.
and Tom Wicker and Scotty Reston and thoughtful people. And they don't operate as a filter. They give interpretations of what all that fire hose of information means, what it could mean, what it doesn't mean, and that's helpful in stimulating people's thinking. I think the quality of journalism has gone down in this country, just as the quality of legislating has gone down. Why that is, I'm not quite sure. Ratings, sensationalism, searching for audiences and advertising, money, I guess, but it's not as good as it used to be.
Right. I think part of it is money. It costs some money to do some fine investigative reporting, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And most of the major newspapers aren't doing it anymore, certainly not the Washington Post. And it is appalling. I think that's the Daschle story is absolutely true. The administration did not want an investigation as to who screwed up in
right.
not warning. I was co-chairman with the late Warren Rudman of a commission that for 2.5 years warned our country that terrorists were going to attack America. And we presented that report to George W. Bush the first week he took office, and he paid no attention.
Thank you so much, John, for your call. I want you to address, as you do in your new book, we've talked a lot about this, but this trend we're seeing since the 1970s, since you left office, of a lot of money going into fewer and fewer hands. You write, not a sustainable path toward the goals of opportunity, justice, and equality. All of this concentrated wealth, which has reached historic proportions. What does it do to the republic?
Well, let me step aside for a moment, because it's all about Ben, what I think. 2 weeks ago, The Economist, probably the best magazine, most thoughtful, well-written magazine in English, they call it a newspaper, we call it a magazine, editorialized that corporate lobbying in America was not only destroying American democracy, it was destroying corporate business, and it was bad for business. They called it corruption. They preempted my word. But so this, and that's a conservative, capitalist, no business magazine. And when people like that begin to say it's out of hand, then it really is out of hand. And they do cite in that editorial column that the fact is it's building an intricate system of privilege and power in Washington that fewer and fewer everyday Americans can penetrate or participate in. It's a closed system.
Chip is our next caller in Rice Lake. Hi, Chip.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Senator, pleasure to speak with you, sir. You made a mention of narrow special interests, and I've been keeping tabs on this sort of thing for probably a decade or now, just as a hobby. And I've noticed that the union special interests are beginning to rival the corporate special interest in terms of PAC money. In fact, if you get on opensecrets.org and look at the PAC money totals, you'll see that actually it's the SEIU at the top of the board, and I think the top 10 in that list are actually unions. And I think the NEA or AFT individually give more PAC money than even AT&T, which is a very large corporation. So I just wanted to get your perspective on that. When you think of special interest, narrow special interest, you also think about the fact that big money from unions is also corrupting our democratic process.
Yeah, I don't want to pick a fight, but the amount of money from all corporations together overwhelms all labor contributions, and everybody knows that labor membership and labor participation in politics isn't what it was 20 or 25 years ago. And so I don't think there is a balancing. I've heard the argument. I heard it back in my day, and I had some union support, some I rejected. And you pick and you choose, but that support in those days was maybe $1,000 or $2,000. That's not what we're talking about with corporate America and with the billionaire special lobbyists like the Koch brothers who pick and choose candidates. There's nobody in labor that's doing that.
And thank you so much, Chip, for the call. Let's go to an appropriate ending point here. Late in the book, you write, deep in the souls of early American Republic founders was the conviction that we had a moral obligation to leave behind a nation better than we found it, but one still solidly based on the timely renewal of the first principles that prevented the erosion by corruption of our Constitution. What about this moral obligation that we have? It seems as though it isn't front and center as often as it should be in the hearts and minds of people who are running the country, and in our hearts and minds as well. Should we think about that? Do we think about that?
We have no choice to. I think as moral individuals, not just as Americans, but as people who profess concern for our children and future generations, I comment in the book and elsewhere that rich people set up legacies for their children of the wealth, best universities, and all kinds of other things. But quite often, they're contributing to causes in politics that are destroying the air and the water that those children are going to breathe and drink. And it makes no sense to me. We leave behind not just private legacies, a little inheritance here or there, or property of one kind or another. We leave a public legacy, and that's what the Commonwealth is. We leave that for future generations. And the preamble of our Constitution says that we are creating this union and this country for ourselves and our posterity. And that's what we always have to keep in mind. Somebody mentioned consumerism. We're not just here to enjoy ourselves and devil take the hindmost in future generations. We leave a country behind. And why people, thoughtful people, wealthy people, educated people, don't pay more attention to the political process with a small p, mm-hmm. and to participation in that process is simply beyond me.
Mm. Well, Senator Gary Hart, this sure was a great way to spend an hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure, and I greatly appreciate your hospitality.
Our pleasure as well. His latest book is The Republic of Conscience. Former Senator Gary Hart, Senator, presidential candidate, the author of, oh my goodness, 21 books, including his doctoral dissertation on Jefferson's ideal of the Republic. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this program, and thank you for listening.